Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. Good to have you with us here on The Mark Steiner Show on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. On our way to our conversation with our international roundtable, I want to remind you The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. Belongs to you. Money comes back in the end. For more information, www.mecu.com or steinershow.org is MeQ, Baltimore Credit Union's banner. So we're now going to take a look at what's happening in American policy, foreign policy, world international policy, and the Middle East. There are so many issues here. There's really not one single really issue that overarches everything. Syria, Iraq, Yemen are in the midst of war that we are in the midst of on one level or another. Countries like Turkey and Jordan and Europe are inundated with refugees. Russia itself is in the midst of much of this madness that's going on in the Middle East. Libya, that was attacked during the Obama administration, has fallen apart and is trying to find some stability. Can it find it at all? Kurds are on the march, and Turkey may be wanting to interject itself in the war in Iraq. The Saudis and the Iranians have a profound struggle with each other on the future of the region, and no one seems to have a handle on what any of this means or where to go. At least that's how it feels to most of us watching from the outside. We are joined once again by Phyllis Bennis, Director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. And Dr. Robert O. Friedman joins us. It's been a while since I've been on. It's great to have him back. Visiting professor of political science at Johns Hopkins University, at the Peggy Meyerhoff Personal Professor of Political Science Emeritus at the Baltimore Hebrew University. And Bob and Phyllis, good to have you with us both.
Good to be with you.
Thank you.
And we all will be joined shortly, I think, by Daniel Soror, who is Director of Conflict Management at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and a scholar at the Middle East Institute, and Ben Norton, journalist and writer and politics reporter, staff writer at Salon. And you all at 410-319-8888. You can tweet us at Mark Steiner. You can also send us an email to talk@steinershow.org. The issue of these issues have become part of the obviously the debate around these elections coming up, but not as deeply as I thought they might be. But Bob Friedman, I think that, you know, we've been on this program together for many years. I think you were my first guests back in 1993 as we began to discuss this, and here we are 23 years later. And I just the what I laid out at the top really does show a chaos that has been created in many ways in the Middle East, but also shows the chaos in terms of not understanding what our policy should be, whether here or Europe or anywhere else. And maybe that's my jaundiced dystopian view, but that's where I am at the moment.
All right, Mark, I certainly appreciate your jaundiced view, and it's good to be on with you again. I think one key in understanding what's going on in the Middle East or not going on as far as American policy is concerned is the perspective of President Barack Obama. Basically, in 2012, he ran on a platform, "I got us out of Iraq," which he did in 2011, "I'm getting us out of Afghanistan," which he promised to do by 2014, "and I'm not getting us into Syria." That's, I think, the basic plan. Now, of course, what's happened with the rise of ISIS, we Americans are back in Iraq. We are not going to be leaving Afghanistan very soon, I don't think. But the problem lies in Syria, because the president is holding to this. We tried our own supply of arms to our own rebel group. That was a disaster. We're now backing the Kurds and some elements of the Free Syrian Army. But meanwhile, the Russians have preempted us, establishing SAM 400s and SAM 300s to really control the airspace in the area, and the president is left looking very bad. He said the Russians are going to get us, and they were going to get into a quagmire in Syria, but it's not been a quagmire. The position of Bashar Assad has been strengthened, and just the other day, Mr. Peskov, who was the Russian spokesman, said that, and this is a change in Russian policy, if it's true, that the Russians are now going to help Assad reconquer all of Syria. That means not just the 80% of the population who lives in the West, but also the East. And that would probably require Russian ground troops. So I think a lot of it is due to, A, U.S. policy in Syria or the lack thereof, and two, the Iran nuclear deal, which, as you know, I supported, had alienated the Saudis and alienated the Israelis. And in part compensation for that, what the United States has been doing is helping the Saudis in Yemen, and that's a very bloody operation. And as you know, recently in September, a major 10-year arms supply agreement with Israel to the tune of $38 billion. So there's a little bit of coherence in the policy. The question is, and hopefully Phyllis will have something to say about this, whether the policy is correct or not.
And before we turn to Phyllis, we're also joined by Ben Norton, journalist and writer, politics reporter, staff writer at Salon. He's written some really interesting pieces. And Daniel Serwer, who is director of conflict management program at the Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and also a scholar at the Middle East Institute. So Daniel and Ben, welcome. Good to have you with us as well.
My pleasure.
Yeah, I'm glad you're both here. So what's this going around the room? I opened up, since you weren't here, by just talking about where we are with three nations caught in war. The United States is involved in one way or another, Syria, Iraq, and Yemen. The refugees flooding into Jordan, Lebanon, Turkey, the Russia versus the United States, the Middle East, Libya, still kind of falling apart, trying to find its center, and much more. So we're just commenting on where this all is and what our policies are saying or not saying. But Phyllis, let me get you to jump in briefly and then get over to Ben and Daniel.
Well, thanks. I think what we're looking at is certainly a set of failed policies, but right now one of the biggest failures is that despite the statement that we hear from President Obama over and over, there is no military solution. The focus is on escalating and maintaining the military. The front page article in the Washington Post this morning, a big piece on the reassessment that's underway about the CIA support for fighters in Syria, which, of course, right now Syria is the centerpiece of the various wars in the region. The war in Syria, as we like to put it, is a set of, I think it's up to, I've been able to count about 11 or maybe 12 separate wars that are being fought to the last Syrian, only one of which, the war between a terrible, violent regime and a large part, although not by any means all, of its population, the Syrian civil war, is only one of those wars. And you have all the other wars that are being waged across Syria, with Syrians doing the dying, but for wars that will not benefit Syria no matter who wins. So the war between Iran and Saudi Arabia over who's going to be the regional hegemon is being fought there. The war between those same two for sectarian clout, is it going to be Sunni or Shia Islam that dominates? The war, which is becoming increasingly not just a cold war of words, but an increasingly hotter war between the U.S. and Russia, is being fought out in Syria. There's a host of other wars. The war, Turkey is at war with the Kurds in Syria. So all of these wars are being fought to the last Syrian with the extraordinary cost that we're seeing. Russian goals in Syria have increased. Earlier, their goals were limited to maintaining their longstanding base at Tartus, their naval base. That's the only military base they have that's outside the territory of the former Soviet Union. They now, of course, are building an air base as well. That and maintaining arms sales to Syria, their only longstanding Arab ally in the region. That was really the main thing. Now, what we see with a much stronger Russian goal, one of the key questions is recognition of Russia as a power in the region. That certainly will be having to be taken into account when negotiations move forward, at whatever point that is, and however many more Syrians will be killed in the meantime. The question of U.S. support for the Saudi war against Yemen, all of these things are escalating the military side. The recognition in the Washington Post piece was sort of interesting, although they didn't say it clearly, that the CIA-backed Free Syrian Army is not fighting against ISIS as the U.S. position was, that this is, we're going to be supporting those who fight against ISIS, not those who are fighting against the regime. as if the U.S. actually controlled who Syrians were going to fight against, and that they are fighting against the regime. This is a regime change operation that's underway. And it's going to leave behind the exact kind of, if it were to succeed, the exact kind of violence and chaos that we see in Libya now, where Libyan weapons are now fueling the conflicts from Mali in Central Africa all the way north through, continuing through Libya. All of the Middle East conflicts are all being fueled by Libyan weapons that have become so massively available since the regime change operation there. And finally, I think the question of where this all fits into our elections and our campaigns, what you mentioned earlier, Mark, is very important, that we're not hearing serious discussion about strategy. No one is pressing. No one is asking, for example, Secretary of State, former Secretary of State Clinton, whether she thinks that her colleague in the Obama cabinet, the then Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates, was he wrong when he said, when he was opposed to a no-fly zone in Libya, he said a no-fly zone starts with going to war against Libya because the first thing you have to do is take out the anti-aircraft system. Libya hardly had an anti-aircraft system of any significance. Syria has a very elaborate system that was put in place first by the Soviets, kept in place by the Russians, staffed partly by Russians. So going to war, as he put it, against Syria means going to war against Russia. Is Secretary Clinton advocating going to war against Russia, or does she think that her former colleague was wrong? No one presses her on that question.
So, Daniel and Ben, let me bring you in. Daniel and Ben, I think that what we've outlined here, I'd like to kind of figure out and pursue what the future might be, given what's happening in the Middle East now. I mean, there seems to be almost an impossibility, Daniel, sort of to kind of create a coherent policy for anybody to address this and really know how to put their hands around this. I mean, in all the years of covering this, I don't think I've ever seen the situation kind of as unsettled and unraveling ever. Daniel?
It is a very complicated situation, but look, I think we have to be careful not to ignore relative successes. And in my book, the fight against the Islamic State so far is a relative success, especially in Iraq and to some extent in Syria as well. The looming challenge beyond that is enormous because the areas taken back from the Islamic State are going to have to be governed. And the question of how they're governed and by whom is a very difficult question, and one which needs to be answered peacefully rather than by further warfare, and that's going to be difficult to arrange. So I do think it's important to recognize that in the main U.S. priority, the president has been very clear about his priorities, and the main U.S. priority is the war against the Islamic State, and that war, insofar as we know, is going reasonably well. The big problem is in Syria, because in Syria you have this very complicated array of different wars. I don't think that Assad is going to be able to reconquer all of the territory of Syria. I think what you're going to get eventually is some kind of equilibrium in which different parts of Syria are governed by different authorities. And you're going to have to rebuild the United Syria from that decentralized Syria. And in some respects, I don't think that's the worst problem to have. I'd like to see the Islamic State control as little of that Syria as possible. But I'm very opposed to seeing Assad reestablish the dictatorship on the whole territory, because I know that that will lead to even more warfare.
Ben Norton, would you pick up on that?
Absolutely. I mean, I think another actor that we haven't discussed that much is Turkey.
Yes, I was about to ask that question. Go ahead.
Yeah, and I think certainly the Syrian government would like to reclaim all the territory in Syria, but I think Turkey is intent on at least taking part of northern Syria You know, they've recently intervened about 2 months ago, and they've been largely fighting Kurdish rebels, ostensibly also fighting ISIS, although Turkey's position on ISIS has been rather mixed for years. Turkey had a porous border allowing ISIS fighters and fighters from other Islamist, including many extremist groups, to cross. Bloomberg published a piece, interestingly, discussing how Erdogan is considering essentially rebuilding parts of northern Syria with large apartment complexes and such, and then taking, you know, the more than 1 million, I mean, close to 2 million now, Syrian refugees from Turkey and relocating them in northern Syria and claiming that essentially as part of this new kind of neo-Ottoman empire. Erdogan also recently discussed Mosul, and he said he invoked a historic document, actually, claiming that Mosul, Erbil, and Kirkuk, you know, major cities in Turkey, I mean, sorry, major cities in Iraq, belong to Turkey. So I think that is going to be a complicating factor that is really going to make this even more difficult. As Phyllis Bennett alluded to, I mean, there are multiple wars going on here, and increasingly a major actor in this war is not just Iran, Russia, and Saudi, but it's also Turkey. I mean, Turkey certainly has played a role, but now it's playing a direct military role. And then I think, you know, getting back to the original question about what the future is, I think one of the primary problems with U.S. foreign policy in the region is the U.S. is, for the most part, aligned with some of the most reactionary and authoritarian regimes in the region, and if not the world. I mean, Saudi Arabia and Qatar and Bahrain, I mean, like, these are monarchies, these are theocratic countries in which, you know, there is no dissent, there is no effective political or civil society. I mean, Saudi Arabia in particular. And we now know from the Podesta emails, the emails from John Podesta, Hillary Clinton's campaign chair, in one of these emails that was released by WikiLeaks, Hillary Clinton forwarded an intelligence memo that appears to have been drafted by Sidney Blumenthal, her aide, and it cites U.S. intelligence sources. And the memo states openly that Qatar and Saudi Arabia were supporting ISIS. And we know that they've supported other extremist groups inside Syria. So I think at one point in the near future, the U.S. is going to have to decide whether it's going to, you know, side against these forces of extremely reactionary authoritarian Islamism, or side with forces that are essentially more modern and democratic. And I think the U.S. policy towards Egypt is another example that could perhaps be discussed. I mean, the U.S. wasn't necessarily super anti-Morsi, but when Morsi was overthrown by a group, Tamarod, which had a little support from the U.S., we now know, when Sisi established a military dictatorship, the U.S. allied with Sisi. And we now also know from the WikiLeaks release of the Podesta emails that in a private speech, Hillary Clinton acknowledged that Saudi Arabia and Qatar saw the Morsi government in Egypt as a threat because it showed that it's possible to have a moderate Islamist government based on democratic principles. But I think, you know, these wars in many ways are kind of a microcosm of this larger dilemma. Saudi Arabia has played a very detrimental role, not just in the region, but in the world, in the Muslim majority world in particular, for many years. You can go back to the war in Afghanistan in the 1980s, where the U.S., Saudi, and Pakistani policy helped create the Taliban and al-Qaeda in order to fight the Soviet Union. And I think in Syria, the situation is certainly even more complex than the war in Afghanistan in the 1980s, but I think there are a lot of important lessons to be learned from that. And not even just that. I mean, Saudi Arabia, of course, is the state ideology of the regime is, and it is a very brutal regime. I mean, if we're going to call any of the other countries in the region a regime, we should absolutely call the Saudi government a regime. And throughout the world, it exports Wahhabism. It's kind of extreme Islamist ideology that the Islamic State in many ways shares, actually, although the Islamic State is against Saudi Arabia now. But in Raqqa, the base, the heart of ISIS inside Syria, they printed out Saudi textbooks, Saudi state textbooks for their children to use. And, you know, there are many instances of those kinds of parallels. So I think, you know, if if we're interested in stopping the spread of extremism, if we're interested in like finding some kind of secular or even if not secular, like a more moderate Islamist stability in the region, I think that the U.S. is absolutely in the future, and not just the U.S., the U.K. and other countries, are going to have to seriously reconsider their strong alliances with the Gulf regimes. And to add, you know, a final point here, I understand that that's complicated because the original reasons the Western countries that are so allied with these countries are is because of oil. And, you know, oil has the problem of oil has in recent years become less complicated because the U.S. only at this point imports about 16 to 18% of its oil from Saudi Arabia. It's diversified its sources. But in Saudi Arabia and the Gulf, it's largely a question of the control of oil prices internationally. I mean, Saudi Arabia has been overproducing oil for some time now, reducing the price on the market. So, I mean, this is connected to global economic issues, and I think it's important to understand how, you know, this series of alliances has exacerbated this problem, and it should be reconsidered in the future.
So I'm going to ask the four of you as we get into this in the next half an hour together, because you all have so much to say, and I deeply appreciate the complexity that you all bring to these discussions, but to kind of focusing in so we can kind of get everybody have a chance to kind of get into it with each other here over the next 40 minutes or so before we have to take a break for the day, and before we have to take a break here. Well, what we should do now, let's take our break now and come right back so we have enough time to get back into the issue and starting with Mosul and what we think is going to happen there and going down the line with our three guests. Just heard Ben Norton, we have Phil Spenis, Daniel Serwer, and Bob Friedman. Stay with us. We'll be right back with our discussion. Don't go away. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. I'm here with Dr. Robert Friedman, who is visiting professor of political science at Hopkins University, Ben Norton, journalist and staff writer at Salon, Phyllis Bennis, director of New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, and Daniel Serwer, who is director of conflict management at the Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, and you all are 410-319-8888. So let's just take very quickly some of the issues that are being dealt with right now. I mean, I think that some of which are on the front burner, people see it in the news, some of which we don't. But again, kind of really kind of a pointed thoughts here so we can get everybody in with their thoughts and ideas. But you know, if we're sitting here advising the President of the United States at this moment, and you look at Aleppo, where there are 250,000 people trapped, where hundreds of thousands of Syrians have been killed and or are in exile internally and around the world, where the huge portion of the losses in Aleppo, as well as been other places, have been the children of Aleppo, civilians caught in the middle of this. People saying that President Barack Obama should be doing something more aggressive. Others saying we should pull out, not do anything that's military. Others saying that there's a diplomatic solution when nobody can figure out what that solution is. So I mean, where do you go when you look at Aleppo at this moment? Let's just take that, for example, before we turn to Mosul. And I do want to get pithy responses if we can. Phyllis?
I think we have to recognize that the military stuff is not working. The situation in Aleppo is disastrous, and it's disastrous, we should be clear, on the west side of the city as well. It's not as bad because there's more bombing coming from the regime. They have the planes. But the opposition forces are shelling on the west side, so it's not a good situation for anybody. It's desperate. It's absolutely desperate. The question is, what's going to stop it? What isn't stopping it is the threat or the existence of more bombing. And we should also be clear that Aleppo has nothing to do with ISIS. We're not hearing about the U.S. military attacks that are ongoing on the eastern side of Syria against ISIS. Aleppo is about the regime. So the question in Aleppo is about whether the regime is going to maintain its control, whether the U.S. is going to move to eliminate the regime's control. And we know where that leads. The problem is there is no military action that is going to make things better. The military action we're hearing about, a no-fly zone, is guaranteed to make things worse because it escalates the fighting directly against Russia. It not only threatens much wider war when you're talking about the U.S. and the Russians going to war with each other. The deputy to Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister just a few days ago, said that, in his view, the situation between the U.S. and Russia was as bad as it has been since 1973. And I think people will remember that in 1973, during the Middle East War at that time, the U.S. actually put its nuclear weapons on high alert aimed at the Soviet Union. That was as close as we have come since that time towards the direct use of strategic nuclear weapons. And if the Russians are saying that it's as bad as it was then, we have to take that very seriously. But in the immediate, the question of children and other civilians that are caught under these horrifying bombs in eastern Aleppo, as well as the problems in western Aleppo, the U.S. entry into that is not going to make it better. Declaring a no-fly zone over Aleppo is simply going to escalate the fighting, with the result that it's going to be more Syrians that are killed. So the question becomes, what's happened in the talks that began Saturday in Lausanne that Secretary Kerry and Foreign Minister Lavrov began? We haven't heard any of the results. We heard they only went on for one day. They reconvened on Monday, and on Wednesday the technical experts were convened, but we've had no information about what might or might not be possible there. We're seeing no effect of it yet. But that doesn't mean that some version of a diplomatic move is going to be impossible. There's going to have to be one, and better that it be sooner rather than later.
So, so Bob Friedman, very quickly
two things very quickly. You have tens of thousands of people starving there. The Russians are pulling off what is considered a colossal bluff here. Even with the Admiral Kuznetsov and the other ships coming to the Mediterranean, they have much less firepower in the area than we do. They're just trying to push President Obama, who doesn't want to go in anyway, just to reinforce that. The question is, what do you do? Well, one thing you do is you can airdrop some food to the people in eastern Aleppo. I think that's possible. You have the UN check the food so it becomes legitimate, and then drop it, and then challenge the Russians. Are you going to shoot down planes carrying food? I doubt it. The Russians have been able to do what they've been doing because President Obama has done nothing. Their firepower is less than ours. We have stealth bombers. We can do a lot of things if there's a will to do it. But there are two basic problems here. The Syrian rebels would much prefer to fight the regime of Bashar Assad than fight ISIS, and that's a given. The other thing we have to come back to very quickly, Mark, is Egypt. I think I slightly disagree with my colleague. Sisi came in a popular coup. Morsi had alienated just about everybody, threatening to close the courts, making court decisions under his directives, and he came in with a powerful coup. The U.S. mismanaged the Sisi situation, and that's why he's turned to the Russians for arms. I mean, if you look at it very clearly, the U.S. was not sure whether there's a coup or not, so what it did was cut some military aid and then restored it. The end result of this, if you look at U.S.-Egyptian relations, at least as I see them, is we alienated both the Morsi supporters of the Muslim Brotherhood and the Sisi regime, which is a pretty good trick.
So we can just focus a whole day on just Egypt by itself, and I think and what happened to a government that was actually duly elected, but and the very confused politics from our end. But Ben Norton, I mean, so if you take between what Bob was saying and what Phyllis was saying, in terms of what American response should be for a place like Aleppo, I think that part of the problem is here is that you America cannot go in militarily. And if they don't, if there's no military solution, there may be no solution. What I'm saying is, you know what I'm saying? I mean, it's like the book Between a Rock and a Hard Place.
No, absolutely. And I think we should also recognize that at the end of the day, the Syrian people are stuck between a rock and a hard place. I mean, there's a lot of discussion in media reports and U.S. politics of the brutality of the Syrian regime. And there's no question that it's brutal. It's widely used torture and violence, etc. But there's also little discussion of the nature of the rebels. And, you know, in Aleppo, the largest, in the sense of the most powerful rebel force, is rebranded al-Qaeda. It's Jabhat Fateh al-Sham, which is now trying to unite the opposition. They recently, officially delinked from al-Qaeda, but the U.S. still recognizes them as a terrorist organization. And it's not just Aleppo. You can go to Idlib and other places. And, you know, these are, there's no question that there still are some, a small number of moderates fighting, but they're vastly underpowered. They're overwhelmed by extremist groups. And if there's no political solution, as Philip Bennett was stressing, I don't think there can be any kind of solution to this conflict. Actually, Hillary Clinton, we were discussing the potential of a no-fly zone. We now know, again, from the WikiLeaks documents that have been released, that in a private 2013 speech to Goldman Sachs, Hillary Clinton acknowledged that a no-fly zone would, quote, kill a lot of Syrians. And as Philip Bennett said, Clinton noted that Syria's anti-aircraft technology is much more advanced than it was in Libya. And she said, Hillary Clinton admitted that it would take U.S. and NATO forces on the ground to enforce it. And actually, Dempsey, the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, admitted in 2012 that this is before Russian intervention, that a no-fly zone would take at least 70,000 U.S. personnel, military personnel on the ground. So, I mean, I think it's really important to keep stressing that there isn't a military solution. There's only a political solution to this conflict. And the U.S. really is in a precarious situation because it considers Jabhat Fateh Hashem, formerly known as Jabhat al-Nusra, a terrorist organization, but then many of the groups that it considers legitimate rebels and that are supported by its allies, Turkey and Saudi Arabia and Qatar, namely Ahrar al-Sham, Sheikh al-Islam, others, are actually working with Jabhat Fateh Hashem, the former al-Qaeda affiliate. So, I mean, there isn't a simple solution to this, and at the end of the day, it's going to come down to whether Saudi Arabia and the U.S. and Turkey and Qatar can agree to make it a political agreement with Russia, Iran, and Syria. And so far, I don't even think necessarily it's been the U.S. that has largely been the worst actor. I think it's largely been Saudi Arabia and, to an extent, also Qatar and Turkey, which have taken a very hardline position of continuing to provide heavier weapons and support to rebels and refusing to make a political agreement with their enemies.
So I think that, you know, Daniel, we bring it back in the conversation on a sore word that I mean, you can't, and what you can't disconnect, unfortunately, from what Ben is describing and Phyllis talked about as well, and Bob, is Mosul, where Turkey is now saying, we're considering coming in, but we're not sure yet, and backing their own Kurdish Peshmerga against the Peshmerga who are seeking independence, who are fighting from Syria and Iraq against ISIS and Mosul. And that's not disconnected from what's happening in Aleppo, and trying to get Turkey and Saudi Arabia to agree to that is also a near impossibility. I mean, I think that's, and I'm not sure who advises who to do what here.
Let me address Aleppo first.
Yeah.
It's absolutely true that you may want a political solution here. That may be the best route. But the notion that a political solution comes independent of the military situation just isn't right. And there are times when military action is necessary in order to lay the conditions for a political solution. The Syrian regime and the Russians have made it very clear that they are seeking a military solution, and they will not stop until they have to stop. It seems to me what the Americans have to consider now is whether they're prepared to allow that to continue, which means to allow the killing of civilians in Aleppo to continue, or they're prepared to take some type of military action. I'm not a fan of a no-fly zone. I think it's an option that is precluded by the air defenses in Syria and the Russian air presence in Syria. I'm not a fan of humanitarian airdrops. They feed very few people and only keep them fed for a short time until they're killed by military means. It seems to me that the one option that the Americans still have left is to use standoff weapons to destroy those military assets that are being used in particular against civilians, and that means the helicopters that drop barrel bombs. Those helicopters belong mainly to the Syrian government. But that would require a decision by the president that we would do something that Congress has not authorized, which is to use our military power against directly against the Syrian government. I'll leave it to the U.S. government to decide whether that's a good option or not, but it's one of the few options remaining that doesn't involve unacceptable risk to Americans. So far as the Mosul operation is concerned, I don't think we should be too confused about what's happening in Mosul. For the moment, Mosul is being attacked from all sides by forces that are allied with each other. It's true that the coalition is a fragile one, but it's also true that they seem to have unity of purpose in destroying the Islamic State and chasing it from Mosul. The real problem comes after what I regard as an inevitable victory of this coalition, because large parts of Mosul will be destroyed, and the question of who holds power in Mosul after the war will be a very delicate one involving the Turks, the Kurds, the Shia, the Sunnis, Baghdad, Erbil. That's a very confused situation post-war.
But
for the moment, at least, the operation seems to be fairly well unified, seems to be fairly successful, and it does fulfill the main U.S. objective, which is to chase the Islamic State from the holding of territory anywhere in Iraq. And we should regard that as a good thing, not as a bad thing.
Can I just respond to that?
Fellas, go ahead. We only have a few minutes, but go ahead, please.
I think there's a very big problem here, which is that it is the U.S. goal of getting ISIS out of the way. We've decided ISIS is the primary danger, but that's not the view of everybody in Iraq and even in Syria. So the question of what happened in Mosul, we can't forget that when ISIS entered Mosul 2 years ago, they were welcomed by a significant part of the population, obviously not everybody, not even all Sunnis. But the government had been corrupt enough, brutal enough, and sectarian enough, the government that we put in power, pay, arm, despite their accountability partly to Iran, were responsible for that government. And that government was bad enough and brutal enough to the Sunni community that Sunnis in many parts of Iraq, but certainly including Mosul, viewed ISIS as the lesser evil that would be appropriate to help them fight back against their own government, against their own regime. And it's in that context that these things become so complex, because the question, when they did that survey of Mosul about 2 months ago, granted it's very difficult to do a survey under conditions of occupation, whether it's ISIS occupation or U.S. occupation, but the surveys do go forward anyway. And whatever it's worth, it indicated that 83% of the population said they did not want to be liberated by this system that was going to put, among other things, the Shia-dominated militias that back up the Iraqi military. They're the strongest part of the Iraqi military, and they're not accountable even to the regime itself. That's who people, Sunnis in Mosul, the majority of the population, are accountable to, and they didn't want to be, quote, liberated from ISIS under those terms. So the question of seeing it as a success because it matches U.S. interests, I think, really denies the fact that this isn't our country. We're invading somebody else's country. We're taking responsibility, we say, for something in somebody else's country that, frankly, emerged as the result of our invasion and occupation of 2003. So defining something as a success because it matches a U.S. stated goal when it flies in the face of what people in that country want, I think is something that we really have to fight against.
I don't think there's any indication whatsoever that the American presence in Iraq is an invasion or flies in the face of Iraqi desires.
What gave rise to ISIS?
All right, Mark, can
Camp
I jump
Buka,
in here,
that's
please?
Where they started.
So we had like 5 minutes left here, so please jump in very quickly here,
okay,
Bob, and then I want to go back to Ben.
The U.S. didn't, you know, you cannot blame the ISIS in 2014 on the U.S. What happened was that the U.S. pulled its troops out of Iraq in 2011, mistake as I viewed it, at the time and now, certainly in retrospect. Then Maliki decided to crack down very, very hard on the Sunni, alienated them, and drove them into the arms of ISIS.
The right, real which was already there from 7 years earlier.
With the population in Mosul, are they more worried about the Shia? And it is worrying when the Shia, when the Iraqi army is carrying Shia flags. Who is going to govern Mosul, and will they respect enough the interests of the Sunni who live there and the Turkmens who live there and the Kurds who live there, which all makes it quite that you will not have 2 years from now, 5 years from now, these people coming back into the arms of ISIS.
So let me jump in because we literally have like 2 minutes left here before we have to go to another segment. Ben, let me let you jump in for a moment.
Yes, I mean, I think it's been covered pretty well. I would just stress a few things. One, just so listeners understand the gravity of the situation, it's important to stress that Mosul is the second largest city in Iraq, and it's an incredibly diverse city. It's very important historically. And what's interesting, I mean, I certainly agree with what others have said about problems of sectarianism, but, I mean, there have been interviews recently with local Sunnis outside and near Mosul who have been liberated by a variety of different forces. This is on the way toward down the heart of Mosul, and by the Iraqi army, and by, for instance, a variety of militias such as Christians who were in the area who took up arms against ISIS. And there have been some interviews done asking them what they thought about the fact that the Iraqi army and allied militias are carrying Shia flags. And they said, well, yeah, I mean, it's certainly not a non-issue to them, but they're much more concerned about defeating ISIS. So, I mean, I think it's a very complex situation, and unfortunately there are few forces that aren't sectarian that are participating in the liberation. And I think the real question to be deliberated, and certainly don't have time, is what will happen after Mosul is liberated from ISIS? Of course, the ISIS forces are largely going to flee, and some have already with the help of human shields and such. And I think many people agree that they're going to go into Syria. And then the question is how ISIS is defeated in Syria. Just because ISIS is largely kicked out of Iraq doesn't mean that it's gone. And then, of course, the problem with the Islamic State is it's kind of transmogrified throughout the planet. It's now in Libya, where, you know, there's essentially no functioning central government after the 2011 NATO bombing and regime change there. And there, the U.S. also recently restarted bombing Sirte, where ISIS has declared its own caliphate. So I think, there's a variety of factors that need to be addressed. And just because, although it's certainly going to be a positive thing, just because Mosul's liberated does not, by any stretch of the imagination, mean that ISIS is anywhere near defeated.
So I wish we had a great deal more time. We're going to have to come back to this in the next week and really kind of look at this maybe bit by bit and in different pieces. I want to thank the four of you so much. This has really been fascinating for our listeners to have different perspectives here. Ben Norton, you just heard, staff writer at Salon, a political reporter there. We're linking to his work. Phyllis Bennis, director of New Internationalism Project at the Institute of Policy Studies. Daniel Serwer, director of conflict management program at the Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. And Dr. Robert Friedman, who is a visiting professor of political science at Hopkins University and the former Peggy Meyerhoff Pearlstone professor of political science at Baltimore Hebrew University. Thank the four of you so much, and I look forward to...